today, will Netflix continue to dominate in the face of increasing competition? And the difference you can make when you register to vote.
Well, then, let's not overcomplicate matters unnecessarily. My name is Elizabeth.
And long live Queen Elizabeth.
It's as if you're looking now at this hugely desirable sports car, high end, and you say to someone, the company that made that, they began doing windscreen washing on an industrial estate. It's that dramatic as to what they've achieved.
Guardian writer and broadcaster Mark Lawson is talking about Netflix.
That has to change. It's time for you to show the world who Thomas is and for you to be proud and excited about life because you deserve to be.
I think I'm gonna have to fight her.
What?
How am I supposed to prison fight an old Russian lady with back problems?
I could have been killed.
Which is exactly why we need her. She's a weapon. Do you seriously want to fight the Demogorgon with your wrist rocket?
They've gone from what was actually quite often in the first decade really seen as a joke company to probably the dismay and fury of the BBC, for example, almost certainly now the superpower, the cultural superpower in the world.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the rise of Netflix. This story begins in 1997. And if I think back to 1997, I think that what I was doing was going out on a typical weekend to my local Blockbuster, hiring a... Was it even DVDs then? Was I hiring a VHS?
VHS it would have been, yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Hiring a VHS. Great film for the weekend. Coming home, making some popcorn and sticking it on. What was the TV market like then?
What the VHS and then DVD rental market addressed was a problem TV had always had, which was its lack of history, its lack of a back catalogue. I mean, you remember renting VHSs. I remember when if you wanted to see a programme twice, you had to wait for the BBC or ITV to repeat it. The story of the last 20 years is making the history, the archive of television, more easily available to the viewer, and that's what Netflix essentially has been about for 20 years.
So how did it all begin for Netflix?
Backstories are really important in the kind of drama that Netflix show, and Netflix has its own backstory. There were two guys in California called Mark Randolph and Reed Hastings. Reed Hastings had taken out Apollo 13, and he forgot to give it back, and he ended up having to pay a fine, which I think was about $40. He was embarrassed about telling his wife.
And I thought, oh, great, now I'm kind of compromising the integrity of my marriage over this late fee. So, of course, I did tell her about it. But it made me think, I can't be the only one who is struggling with this late fee thing.
He then went to the gym, and in the gym, he had this light bulb moment. He thought, well, you only pay to use a gym when you need to. In the origin story, he thought, I've got to come up with a way in which people can rent home entertainment without constantly worrying about taking it back and pushing it through a letterbox.
Driving to work, Reed mentioned offhand that he'd read about this new technology called the DVD. It was for movies. It was thin and small, the size of a music CD. And we chatted a bit, and it gave us an idea.
So he came up with this idea of a VHS and then quite rapidly after that DVD, postal rental service. So you would choose online, it would be sent to your address, and then when you'd finished with it, you sent it back.
If you're busy like me, going to the video store is a hassle. With Netflix, just make a list of the movies you want to see. And in about one business day, you'll get three delivered to your house.
We now know that Blockbuster isn't what it once was. What did they make of Netflix at the time?
Quite early on, they offered Blockbuster a 49% share for $50 million, which at the time was thought to massively overprice. the company. And
so what did Blockbuster do?
Well, they thought it was hilarious, and they just they said, no, that's ridiculous. You're completely mad. Get out of here.
But in 2000, they were on a very different trajectory. So we were on track to do $3 million. Blockbuster was on track to do $6 billion. We had 100 employees. They had 60,000 employees. They had 9,000 stores. And so when we tried to call them up to get a meeting, they wouldn't even take our calls.
And this is why, you know, eventually when they make the Netflix miniseries about the creation of Netflix, which can't be far away, this will be one of the episode endings, is when Blockbuster say, get out of here. And then Blockbuster will say, in a year's time, you'll be coming crawling back here and begging us to put money into you. But it just didn't happen. And yeah, it went exactly the other way.
Right. And meanwhile, Netflix always seemed to be ahead of the game, from posting DVDs to streaming.
Netflix, its great vision was a sort of long tail for television and film, that you would build up this huge library from which people would be able to choose themselves. That's when they began to take off and be taken seriously, because it was a very attractive model to consumers. And then the next huge decision they made, again technology-led, was to make their own content. And that's when we get to House of Cards.
You mentioned House of Cards, and that is the moment when Netflix really started to grab viewers' attention.
It's really about making the brand stronger so that more people want to join, and House of Cards absolutely did that, because then many people would talk about it and associate that brand with us.
It was 2013. It was incredibly ambitious. What felt different about that show?
It's a really interesting question there, because you see, it wasn't different in one sense. I very vividly remember a very high up person at the BBC at the time saying, everyone's going on about Netflix, but when you look at it, they've just remade a BBC hit.
It is different to the original.
No, but that was the view they took. And it's really interesting they took that view. They said they've gone on and on about, we're going for original content, and they've done a remake. However, what was crucial about the Netflix version of House of Cards is that it's quite tempting when talking about Netflix at this stage to say they went from a technologically led model, which was streaming other people's content, to a creative model of making their own stuff. But while that's true, there was an overlap, because what they'd done with House of Cards was they'd realized that from having subscribers, they had all this information about what people liked, and really reliable information. They knew how many of their subscribers in America had watched the British version of House of Cards. And they realized that it was, to them, and perhaps to us, an unexpected hit.
It had a cult following.
Well, I think beyond cult. I don't think they have put $100 million, which is what they did, behind a cult. You never know with Netflix, and it's infuriating because they won't release figures, but the figures must have been significant. So this is where the creativity comes in, because it was a clever thing. They thought, we could take this Palace of Westminster, do it in Washington.
For those of us climbing to the top of the food chain, there can be no mercy. There is but one rule: hunt or be hunted.
They apparently were slightly worried at the time about whether an audience would accept a deeply criminal, corrupt, borderline insane president of the United States, such as Francis Underwood, played by Kevin Spacey. But, you know, history moves on and these things become more plausible than perhaps they were at the time.
These two tech experts from Silicon Valley, I mean, they didn't make that content, did they?
No, those two guys didn't make it. They didn't make any of the stuff. Nor, in fact, did the person who was responsible for the decision to remake House of Cards, who was Ted Sarandos, who they'd worked with in Silicon Valley.
Right.
House of Cards is Shakespearean drama.
Right.
It's about
right.
sex and power and greed. It had nothing, barely had anything to do with DC politics, really, if you think about it.
Right, sure.
And,
and they brought him in to be the creative power. And then what they also did, and this has proved absolutely crucial to their business plan and their success, was to get absolute top-end talent. So Kevin Spacey, who at the time was seen as a bona fide a movie star because of Usual Suspects and others. But even then, and this is only 6 years ago, there was quite a lot of prejudice in Hollywood movie industry towards TV.
And you've met Ted Sarandos, who's Netflix's chief content officer. What was he like?
I have met him a couple of times. What's interesting to me about him is that he's a literary type. He talks about books a lot of the time. In the other great artistic change that Netflix has brought, which is box set binging, that's specifically in Ted Sarandos's head, was an attempt to create a television experience, which was like sitting down with one of those huge Victorian novels that would be in several volumes and several thousand pages, and you'd work your way through them. And he was always very specific about that he wanted to bring the immersive reading experience to viewing. And that's how he got to the box set.
The question, then we'd go back and forth, like, let's do four episodes and then wait a month and then do four more. And I said, look, we're not going to guess right. So let's just give it all and then we'll see how it plays out.
What was Netflix starting to offer that the other broadcasters weren't?
The key to Netflix, to some degree, was what it didn't have to offer. What the BBC and ITV and others had always dreaded was that an organization would come along that didn't have to fill 24 hours a day on several channels, didn't have to do religious broadcasting, show the Queen's speech, buy sports rights. And it happened with Netflix. They just decided what we're going to do is we're going to do high-end drama. We're going to do some documentary, bit of children's programming. So they cherry-picked. And what they were able to offer was incredibly high budgets and pretty much total creative freedom. The success of Netflix is essentially based on giving control back to the viewer. You had lots of people who had held the title of controller at various British broadcasters, and they were really saying, we know what people want to watch, we know when they want to watch it, 9 o'clock on a Sunday night, etc., and we'll give it to them. Netflix was saying, no, we know what people want to watch, but we know that because we have looked. We've effectively talked to people by looking at the data of what they want to watch. And it's that curve from the controller of a British broadcaster to self-scheduling that is where Netflix have made the success.
I mean, that is so fascinating. Basically, the technology behind Netflix, the algorithm, revolutionized the way that TV worked because the control, as you put it, was put in the hands of the viewer. With that in mind, if we look at some of the shows that Netflix brought out, the women's prison drama Orange is the New Black, Queer Eye, Stranger Things, Ava DuVernay's Heartbreaking When They See Us about the Central Park Five, and Unbelievable, it's had a lot of praise for offering us more diverse options, putting the experiences of LGBTQ people, people of colour and women at the centre of shows.
Well, when you first join Netflix, you're very likely to be kind of a youngish male, you know, the early tech adopter and all that kind of stuff. And then as you get into the mainstream, you know, we're 100 million plus subscribers now, you start crossing all demographics. So our demographic isn't like a network, it's like all of television.
That, though, has been quite surprising because the risk that was clearly seen of their algorithm is that you go on giving people more and more of what they want. So people have watched the British House of Cards, they watch the American one, so you keep giving them political series. I think, and they're such a mysterious organization, and they won't really talk about to any great degree about how the decisions are made, I think they must have done some social engineering in terms of some of those shows.
By social engineering, I assume you mean they weren't driven by the numbers in the first instance when choosing those dramas. Take Unbelievable, a show about rape.
I know this is hard, but I need to ask you some questions about what happened.
He tied my hands. He said if I screamed, he'd kill me.
I mean, not just one, but probably three brilliant female leads, incredible success, hugely talked about, critically acclaimed. I mean, we've heard the excuse from commissioners that the reason white men are often at the centre of shows is because that's what viewers want to watch. I mean, the huge success of these Netflix shows demonstrates that's just not true.
I know, it's clearly not true, and it never has been. Unbelievable, you see, if you imagine that being made at a conventional broadcaster, American Network, BBC, ITV, there would be agonies of how many warnings do we need to put on this because of its content and its subject matter? Do we have to tone some of it down in case it's triggering? And, you know, all those can be reasonable questions. But again, Netflix doesn't have to worry about that.
And it's easy to say now that other broadcasters had to sit up and take notice of Netflix. But even in 2013, Netflix's rivals were way behind them, weren't they?
I think that's exactly right. You talk about people sitting up, right, but with contempt, really, and dissent for Netflix. I saw it happen in a room. There was a dinner, and there were very senior people there from the BBC, ITV, Channel 4. The guest of honour was a senior figure from Netflix. And this very experienced figure from British TV, traditional British TV, said, what I'm interested in is how you're going to deal with the flops when the flops start coming. The senior figure from Netflix said, but we're not going to make any flops. There was this astonishing exhalation in the room and people were laughing and thinking this guy is completely mad.
I bet some of those guys are not laughing now. But the truth is, Netflix has made some flops.
They have made some terrible, terrible stuff that nobody in their right mind would want to watch. And maybe they had an algorithm that showed that there were enough people not in their right mind for it to be worth making this thing, and that the 13% of people who watched it would be enough. But who knows?
It's pretty clear that Netflix has revolutionised television across the world. But how was this broadcasting giant built financially? Dan Milmo is The Guardian's deputy business editor.
Netflix's financial model is, well, you can look at two basic facts about it. Investors love it. It's worth about $130 billion. That's about £100 billion. That just means whenever it goes to the market and says, we would like quite a bit of money, please, the market gives them that money in the form of debt, largely.
So it's borrowed a lot of money in order to make such good content.
Yeah, it's borrowed about $12 billion. Its liabilities, or effectively commitments for programs that it's buying off other producers or is going to make in the future, is about another $20 billion. That's a lot of money for a media company to be committed to.
Wow, that's $32 billion. But it has also got nearly 160 million subscribers across the world, so it must have decent revenues.
The amount it spends on content, marketing and other costs will exceed what it earns from subscribers by around $3 billion. It's spending an awful lot of money to get subscribers in, and it's not quite there in terms of having enough subscribers to be a fully viable business.
Why does it take such a massive risk?
It's a bit of a sort of Silicon Valley growth model. You just come in, disrupt a market and spend a lot of money doing it, and then eventually you sort of look upon a blasted heath of competition and you just hoover up all the money, all the subscribers that are out there. It's just that, unfortunately, Netflix has done so well with proving there's a business model for streaming. Everyone else has decided to pile in. And that's Netflix's biggest problem, probably, is just the amount of competition coming in now, but also the sheer quality of it. You know, Disney, Apple, HBO, NBC Universal, which is a big US network, they're all launching services that are just going to have a lot of content on there that Netflix subscribers might fancy subscribing to.
So what, in its mind, it had this kind of genius idea. It took a monopoly in this market. It took content from everywhere and it didn't mind borrowing because no one could compete with it. How, if you're in that model, do you cope with all these new competitors?
Well, they've got a number of choices. They probably can't raise subscriber prices in order to make money. So they've probably got the option of cutting the monthly cost of their service. A bit risky. Perhaps they could come down to meet Disney's level, but shareholders won't appreciate that. The other choice, and this is one that they tend to go for, and I think that's shown by their debt and liabilities, they just spend more money on content. And probably what they'll do is just, you're going to see a lot more Netflix originals coming through and a lot more cash being burnt in a bid to keep these competitors at bay.
Could Netflix collapse? And if so, what would that mean?
I think Netflix is far too big a brand and it's got far too many subscribers and it's got far too much good content already. It is building up a bit of a library to collapse completely, i.e. to disappear from our screens. I think it is possible that because of the amount of competition in the streaming space, you're going to see takeovers. You know, not to forget, the boss of Disney the other day was saying that Disney and Apple should have merged or could have merged had Steve Jobs stayed alive. So you probably could see Netflix joining one of the other big media firms or being bought by one of the big hardware firms like Apple.
Mark, we've talked about the incredible rise of Netflix, the quality of content, yeah, and some flops, but some pretty amazing things. We've talked about how it's revolutionised the way we watch television. But these days, the best stuff's not always on Netflix. These days, rivals are making really, really amazing things and are catching up in terms of the overall model.
I still personally find that you're more likely to find good stuff on Netflix, but it's getting more complicated. And it's interesting, you know, on the day we're talking, the people who write about TV for The Guardian, we've just been asked for our 20 favourite programmes of the year. And in the last few years, you have to start really consciously editing out the number of Netflix ones you've got. So they do have a really high strike rate.
And does Netflix have a high strike rate for you this year?
This is where how things have changed. My number one show was Chernobyl, or Chernobyl, depending on how you want to pronounce it, which is HBO Sky Atlantic. And also in my top four was Succession, which is HBO Sky Atlantic. I think it's fair and correct to say that even 3 years ago, we would have expected those to be on Netflix. Interestingly, anecdotally, I find a lot of people, if you say, watch Succession, watch Chernobyl, they say, oh, I'll have a look on Netflix, which is interesting because people still think the best stuff is there, but it perhaps isn't.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Mark Lawson and Dan Milmo. Coming up, Lara Spirit on tomorrow's voter registration deadline. Now, tomorrow marks the deadline for registering to vote in the general election, and an estimated 9 million people are either missing from the electoral roll or not registered at their current address. For Lara Spirit of Vote for Your Future, registering is easier than you might think and might make all the difference.
Voter registration in the UK is one of the most important political issues that we're currently facing. Millions are still missing from the electoral register, and whether or not they like it are set to wake up on the 12th of December and be unable to cast their vote in what is potentially the most important general election of my lifetime so far. Young people especially are likely to be missing from the electoral register, 1 in 3 currently. That's compared to just 6% of pensioners who aren't signed up to vote. Given the last few years of British politics, where we've seen young people make a name for themselves as a generation on a number of different issues that they care so passionately about. We've seen millions march through the streets on Brexit, on climate change, on period poverty. And this election is going to be defining for all of those in many ways. So tomorrow midnight is the last big push we can have for people to register to vote. And it's incredibly important that if young people want their voices heard on these issues and they choose who it is that's going to represent them. The myths about voter registration, I think, are often that you're automatically registered to vote. It might seem that it's common sense that when you turn 18, you'll automatically be able to walk into your polling booth and cross a box. And while I think it should be that way, and while it actually wouldn't be particularly difficult to make it so, you still need to actually register to vote. So unless you've actively done something, it's very, very unlikely that you're going to be able to vote in this election if you haven't signed up. Another myth is that you can only register in one place. If you're a young person, this is particularly relevant. You can actually be registered to vote in two places. Because we live in a first-past-the-post system, this is incredibly important. So your vote might matter a huge deal more in one seat than it does in another. And while you certainly can't vote in two locations, you definitely can register and then choose where you want to vote. And you should check where your vote is most powerful. There are definitely a number of people who will be hoping, if you're a young person, that you don't vote, depending on what seat you are, depending on what your political motivations are. I would think very long and hard about that, and I would think very long and hard about the power that you really do have, especially if you're living in a marginal seat, to make a difference in this election. In Canterbury, for example, one of the most famous marginal seats was won by only 300 votes in the last election. There you've got a student population of 40,000. In North East Fife, which was won by two votes in 2017, you've got a student population of 10,000. It's incredibly important that young people vote, because actually in these seats, they really, really are going to make a difference. So if you type register to vote into Google, you'll have the GovUK site, which will come up. You'll need a couple of things. You'll need your national insurance number and some information about where you live. It's incredibly easy. It takes under 5 minutes to do. There was a lot of concern with the date of the winter election that it might put off some young people from voting. Actually, it looks like it's going to be anything but. We've seen a historic jump in the numbers of youth registrations. There's actually been double the amount of under 25s who have registered to vote since the election's been called over the same period compared to 2017. And obviously in 2017, we had the famous youthquake. 1.5 million under 35s have registered to vote since the election was announced. That's crazy. So I really think there might be a historic turnout in this election. The last few years of British politics have been incredibly frustrating as a young person to watch, and I've never felt so impotent and powerless. But I would say that finally I do have a chance to make a difference, and I do have a chance to vote, and that is a huge privilege. So I would say that if you are also looking on at British politics at the moment and you feel a similar sense of dismay, this is still an incredibly important election to vote in, and it could well lead to a resolution on whatever issue it is that you care most about.
That was Lara Spirit. My thanks to her and to Mark Lawson and Dan Milmo. Today's episode was produced by Hannah Moore, Nicola Kelly and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.